It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, all the male members of the deer family, your whitetail, mule deer, elk, moose, they grow and shed antlers each year. An expert tells us more about hunting for those shed antlers that they leave behind. First, President Trump signed a proclamation creating new tariffs yesterday, despite opposition from many Republican leaders.
Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum. We will have a 25% tariff on foreign steel and a 10% tariff on foreign aluminum when the product comes across our borders.
As the president geared up for yesterday's actions, the stock market reacted badly and his top economic advisor resigned. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan was one of many Republicans raising concerns.
There is clearly abuse occurring. Clearly, there is overcapacity, dumping, and transshipping of steel and aluminum by some countries, particularly China. But I think the smarter way to go is to make it more surgical and more targeted. So I think 232 is a little too broad, and I think it's more prone to retaliation. And so what we're encouraging the administration to do is to focus on what is clearly a legitimate problem and to be more surgical in its approach so that we can go after the true abusers without creating any kind of unintended consequences or collateral damage.
Chris Farrell is with us now to take a closer look at these tariffs and what their consequences might be. He's a senior economics contributor for American Public Media's Marketplace and an economics commentator at Minnesota Public Radio. Chris, good to have you back.
Thanks to have me. Well, it's a pleasure.
The tariffs here are kind of a moving target. Now it sounds like Canada and Mexico might be exempted pending negotiations. Other allies might be able to negotiate something out of this. What do we know about tariffs as they stand right now?
Well, it's a little bit of a mess, and as you were in the news report saying earlier, there are Wisconsin companies that are looking for exemptions also from the tariff because they're relying on certain steel imports. So it's a moving target. It's raised a lot of confusion. But one way of thinking about the core of this issue is that it's alienated a lot of people, particularly in Europe and elsewhere around the world, Japan. And so this has sort of caused this consternation, this eruption of worry about the global trading system, even though, as you mentioned, I love the expression, it's a moving target. So who's going to have to pay this? How much is it? Is it really going to be an effect? Is it really a negotiating ploy for the North American Free Trade Agreement? I mean, all of that we'll see. But I think the clear impact of this is to alienate our trading allies.
And let's look at some of the consequences of that. We're hearing that the European Union, for example, is reaching into their bag of tricks for possible retaliation, including some products here in Wisconsin, the cranberries, the Harley-Davidsons,
right.
Kentucky bourbon, homes of Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. I guess that's relevant.
Yep.
What kind of options does, say, an entity like the EU have here?
So that it's a very smart policy on their part because they're not declaring trade war. It's not across the board. And they're trying to, as you're mentioning, and these are also not only is it because of Paul Ryan, Representative Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, it's also these are iconic American products. And so, you know, it's a smart move. It's an attempt to try and limit the damage because no one really wants a trade war. And that is the big fear here, that something spirals out of control. And the other thing that is really disturbing a lot of people and a lot of the commentary, steel, aluminum, using the national security, what was it, Paul Ryan, you know, the 232, this national security reasoning, you can put anything under national security, anything. And that's the way it's written. And that's one of, again, that's one of these moving targets. That's one of the uncertainties that has been raised by this. They're using this national security justification, but you can use national security justification on almost any product or service. And so, again, how far is the administration going to push this? There's a lot of uncertainty.
Let's talk about that security angle a little more. Here's President Trump again talking about the tariffs.
This is not merely an economic disaster, but it's a security disaster. We want to build our ships, we want to build our planes, we want to build our military equipment with steel, with aluminum from our country. And now we're finally taking action to correct this long overdue problem. It's a travesty. Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum.
So with that idea you're expressing there, Chris, that anything can fit into this. So yeah. Our troops need uniforms so we could protect the textile industry. We need to feed people and the military, so any food stuff could fall under that, for example.
Right. And this is the concern, because you can just exactly what you're doing. Now, of course, you know, one reaction to that is, well, that's absurd. We wouldn't be doing that. But then again, what's the metric? What's the measure? And national security. So Greg Ip of the Wall Street Journal has a very nice piece. And if you really want to look at aluminum, it's bauxite. And bauxite is a critical ingredient toward aluminum. And it all comes in from overseas. So if you wanted to do a national security, it would be looking at bauxite. And I think that's part of how to understand what is going on with these tariffs. We're coming into the midterm elections. President Trump wants to shore up his base. These are popular in his base. And I think that, so from a purely political point of view, not political in Washington, D.C., not political in London or in Bonn, but political in terms of thinking of his base here in the United States, it's probably a fairly popular move despite all the upset in large parts of the global economy.
Talking to Chris Farrell from Marketplace with the latest on the tariffs proclaimed yesterday by President Trump on aluminum and steel. Chris, you've talked elsewhere about a possible consequence here. You say there is a real trade concern in the industries of the future. We're worried about China. We need allies on this. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, aluminum, steel, those are the great industries of the past, and they're wonderful industries today. But look at the future, you know, digital data, the robots, autonomous driving vehicles, the self-driving vehicles, artificial intelligence. And last July, China came out with this statement, 29 pages, I think it was, that by 2030, they wanted to have a $150 billion artificial intelligence industry, and they wanted to dominate this industry. And what China's doing is a program of mercantilist innovation. They're strongly protecting these highly innovative industries, and they're performing a sort of predatory actions overseas. Now, in order to combat that, the U.S. needs allies. We need the Europeans along with us. We need the Japanese along with us. We need the Latin American countries along with us in order to combat what is, you know, a real risk out there in the global system. So to me, that's the real political economic effect of these tariffs. Our allies are mad. And they don't trust us. And they think that we are just sort of walking away from this global trading system at a time when I think we need to protect, in the smart sense of the word, the global trading system, which, by the way, our Google, our Facebook, Apple, Amazon have flourished in.
And yesterday, Chris, a new version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership was signed by 11 U.S. trading allies. That includes countries like Australia, Canada, and Japan. United States was in it for most of the way, and now we're out. It was a big punching bag in the 2016 election for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in particular. So this is a new and different and smaller Trans-Pacific Partnership. What do you make of it?
So what I make of it is that, this is partially a statement by other countries saying to the U.S., well, okay, if you're not going to, you know, defend the system, we'll create other deals that don't include you. But this is really the risk. This is the risk that's going on right now, is that you look at the past 70 years, we've had this rule-based, market-based, multilateral global trading system, used to be with what we called GATT, and then now with the World Trade Organization. And there's all these free trade agreements. And I know you can put free trade in quotes, and that's always important to do. But nonetheless, lower tariffs, more trade, rule-based, market-based. And now what the U.S. seems to be doing is walking away from the system that it built. And other nations are saying, okay, if we're more on our own, then we are not going to participate as much in this system. And by the way, the United States benefits from this global trading system. So that's the risk to be concerned about with the tariffs. The actual tariffs themselves, probably not that important. They're really pretty small. But what is the bigger message in the tariffs themselves?
Chris, before I let you go, one concern about free trade, in quotes or not, yeah, is that any country is going to get some benefits from it, but there are going to be sectors of any country that are probably going to be hurt for it, that aren't as competitive in certain ways. Is one of the failings of the way, say, the United States has done trade that we haven't paid enough attention to those people who have literally lost their jobs because of foreign competition?
Absolutely. This is like the, this is so important that, you know, we have the commanding heights of our economy are saying free trade is good for you. And you're absolutely, but there are, and they, there are, you know, I don't like to use the word losers, but there are people on the wrong side of that trade. And so where is the training budgets? Where is the moving assistance? Where, you know, where is the help to get other jobs in other places? We've had an attitude of you're on your own. Hey, you lose your job. You're on your own. Go get another one. And most nations that are exposed to trading, heavy trading, they have these systems that help the workers find new jobs. By the way, tariffs, they don't help workers get new jobs. What the evidence shows is that most of the benefit of the tariff goes to shareholders and senior management, not the workers.
We'll leave it there for now, Chris. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That's Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for American Public Media's Marketplace and an economics commentator for Minnesota Public Radio. Wisconsin is a great state to participate in a different kind of treasure hunt, one that gets you outside, pacing fields and properties with your eyes trained on the ground. It's shed hunting, looking for antlers that bucks have shed through the winter season. Are you a are you a shed hunter yourself? Do you want to talk about a great antler that you found or how you got hooked into it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Joe Shedd is the former managing editor of Deer and Deer Hunting Magazine. He's author of the book Shed Hunting, A Guide to Finding White-Tailed Deer Antlers, and creator of two DVDs on the subject. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about shed hunting. How did you get started?
I guess it was just something when I was a kid, you know, you didn't hear about people finding antlers a whole lot because hunting practices were different. People shot the first buck they saw in Wisconsin, and that has kind of changed a little bit. People are passing up younger bucks and trying to shoot older ones, letting the younger ones survive. And some, you know, deer are living longer, and they're getting a chance to shed antlers, and my college roommate was finding some sheds when we were one spring, and he kind of got me walking with him. And man, when I found that first one, it was just, you know, it was a rush, you know, and I've always wanted to find more.
And so since then, you've been doing this more and more, and now you're kind of an authority on hunting for antlers.
Yeah, I guess so.
What's your advice for somebody who thinks, yeah, this would be a lot of fun? How can someone get started?
Well, I guess the first thing is to try to figure out a good place to look for deer antlers. Find a, you know, whether it's a park or some kind of area where there's no hunting allowed, where you are allowed to collect antlers. That way more deer can survive. If you're going out on DNR land, you know, you're obviously allowed to go out there walking, but a lot of deer get harvested. Or maybe find some private property and get permission from a farmer if you're, you know, driving around and seeing a lot of deer in that area. Find a good place with a lot of deer would be the first step.
And do a lot of people do this? Are a lot of people out there shed hunting?
It's really gotten me popular in the last 10 or 15 years or so. Some of the areas where I go on public land now, I see footprints in the spring, and just by the way they're walking, I know that that's what they're doing, and there's a lot of competition out there for it now.
Yeah, so you're out there, you're walking, you're looking for antlers, some shed antlers. How do you do it? How do you make sure you don't just walk right by them?
Well, it's easy to do. I'm sure I've done it. I've stepped on them before and kicked them before. you know, you first got to look for the bedding areas and the feeding areas. That's kind of what deer spend most of their time doing in the winter and time. Deer lose their antlers from about December till generally around March. Some will still have antlers right now. Most should be shed out by now. And you find where they're feeding, whether it's a cornfield or, you know, in the woods, if it's natural browse, like what red oak or dogwood or maybe acorns, and look in those areas and then check in the bedding areas. It might be a coniferous forest, pine trees or cedars, or maybe some thick brush like dogwood or willow, places they can take some cover. And that's where they spend a lot of time, especially if you can find the beds on the ground, the little depressions in the snow or in the dust, and just kind of keep your head down and try to find the grain from the chaff. You know, they sheds look a lot like sticks and grass, and it takes some looking, and it's easy to miss them, but spend enough time doing it and you'll come up with one.
I want to take a caller now. Joseph is with us in Milwaukee. Joseph, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so I have a buddy that has an interesting mantelpiece at his house. I was inquiring about it. He said he was going walking through the woods one day, and he saw a little kind of like a gentleman that's helping us out with how to find antlers this time of year. It was just kind of poking out of the ground, and he thought it was an antler or potentially just a stick sticking out of the ground, but after he dusted it off, what it actually was two antlers that had come together, just locked together, and he couldn't take them apart. And when he cleaned it out, that's what it was. It might have been like two six-point antlers that just came together, and he just never tried to take it apart. And now it's just this really cool mantelpiece.
Wow.
That's just sitting on his bar downstairs in his basement, and something that you probably couldn't recreate or probably just so rare to find. But I don't know. Is that something that's pretty rare to find?
Joseph, thanks. So, Joe, two sets of antlers intertwined with each other.
Yeah, that's pretty rare. Bucks will fight for dominance and mating rights in the fall, and so they'll interlock their antlers, and on occasion they'll get locked together, and you hear about it every year where they'll become unlocked and they won't be able to get apart, and then usually ends up dying, whether they starve or get attacked by predators. I'm not sure if the caller was referring to if the buck had actually shed or not, too, but it would be possible that they might lock together and then the buck might shed its antler and carry around the other buck's antler. That would be really rare. I've never heard of that, but that would be possible, too.
Joseph, thanks for that call. We're talking to Joe Shedd. He's the author of Shed Hunting, A Guide to Finding White-Tailed Deer Antlers. And is it like with hunting, more points for more points on the antlers?
Well, you know, everybody wants to find a big antler, but when you think about it, the hard ones to find are the little ones.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody can spot a big one, but obviously everybody wants to find the big ones.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share a story with you. I have a marsh area, kind of wooded marsh here across the street from me, and it was a fluke. I looked down, and here was a six-point, one half of a six-pointer. Well, I told a friend of mine that makes lamps and stuff, chandeliers out of antlers, and what he said to me, and I don't know if you use the same method, he said they don't like the uneven weight, and they'll try to knock off the other half. And he says what you want to do is circle up from where you found that one and then walk down each trail, and sure enough, it was within 100 feet I found the other half.
No kidding.
Yeah. Boy, I was, and it was around this time of year, maybe a little earlier,
huh.
But boy, I was just like, wow, this is
Randy, thank you so much for sharing that. So, Joe, have you had that situation? You find half an antler and you start looking for the other half?
Yeah. What's interesting about the shedding process is sometimes they'll drop both the antlers together. They'll be laying side by side. But more often than not, they won't. So, yeah, he's exactly right. That's good advice. If you do find an antler, try to figure out, if you can find the trail or see the tracks where that deer was walking. Try to follow it, up and down, because you don't know if that's the first one or the second one. Try to follow the tracks, each direction as far as you can, and make some circles after that if you can't find any tracks or anything. And sometimes you'll get lucky and find it. Sometimes you won't. It might be several days before they drop the second antler. It just varies.
We heard from Ben from Appleton. Ben wants to know if it's possible to train your dog to hunt for sheds. Have you ever heard of that, Joe?
Yeah, that is something that's gotten really popular in the last few years, and they are very good shed hunters. There's videos out there, and there's people that are actually instructing people how to teach their dogs to find antlers, and it's very effective.
Joe, it sounds like part of the fun here is, well, of course you're getting outside, and that's great, but part of the fun is really having to understand deer behavior and learn more about it to know where to look for and spot these shed antlers, right?
Yeah, definitely. I always tell people I've learned more about deer hunting, just from my, from shed hunting than from reading books or watching videos or anything. It just forces you to be successful. It forces you to really understand how the deer are relating to their landscape.
Have you had luck? Have you been out this season?
I have not been out too much. We got some really deep snow here. I live in northern Minnesota now, from central Wisconsin originally. I did get one 8-point set that was laying side by side back in January, and I'm impatiently waiting for the snow to melt right now.
And for the serious shed hunters, do people have their secret spots where they have good luck and maybe don't want to tell everybody else about?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's when you find a good spot, you definitely want to kind of keep it to yourself. I've kind of let some people in on some areas in the past, and it's come back to bite me. But, yeah, people are definitely secretive about it.
So, Joe, I imagine you've collected a lot over the years. What do you do with them all?
They're my children. Those are my babies. some people will make crafts out of them. Some people will, use them for dog chews or sell them, to people that do crafts and stuff. I keep all my antlers. I have a whole room in my basement that's just covered with them. Actually, most of the rooms in my house have antlers in right now.
And so when somebody stops by, they get the tour of antlers?
Yeah. And that's the thing about antlers, whether you're a deer hunter or not, people are just fascinated by them. They're this bone that goes from nothing and in the course of 4 months grows into this big bone that eventually, falls off. And they're just fascinating to look at. And, I'll be sitting there watching TV and just twirling one around in my hands, just kind of feeling it. They're just neat things.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I was glad to be on the show today.
That's Joe Shedd. He's the former managing editor of Deer and Deer Hunting Magazine, and he's the author of the book Shedd Hunting, A Guide to Finding White-Tailed Deer Antlers. He's been talking to us about a shed hunting season, and that's right now. It was the big show in the cheese world this week at the World Championship Cheese Contest in Madison. Producer Dean Canetta has been riding the cheese roller coaster over the last few days. Dean, the big cheese, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Good to be here.
You have been watching this thing online through the week, through the ups and downs, and you went last night to the big finals, right? Set the scene for us.
Well, it's a great event. There's more cheese than you could ever hope to eat.
It's like Willy Wonka factory, but cheese.
Oh, yeah. That's a big selling point. But it's also a who's who of the cheese world. I mean, you have cheese scientists, cheese makers from all over the world, men and women who are really geniuses in their field. So it's easy to get a little starstruck. And there's also a great energy there. People were excited and anxious to find out about the winner.
And speaking of anxious, you were worried as some of the first categories were decided this week. Not a lot of Wisconsin showing up in the top 20 at the outset.
I was a little upset about how we were performing at the beginning, but it ended up that we had five cheeses in the top 20.
Five cheeses. Okay, tell us a little, before we get to the big winner, the spoiler alert, not Wisconsin, sorry, tell us about some of the Wisconsin cheeses that did score here.
Up in the top 20, these are the cheeses that had a chance to win.
The grand prize here.
Yes, the big best
all
in
categories.
Show ribbon. Yep. We had English Hollow Cheddar from Maple Leaf Cheese in Monroe. Also, Saxon Creamery's Mild Gouda, that's made in Cleveland, Wisconsin. Two cheeses from Sartori in Plymouth. Their Espresso Bellavitano was in the top 20, and also their Pastoral Blend. This is a mix of sheep, cow, and goat milk. Their head cheesemaker, Mike Matuszewski, makes this alongside his handpicked successor, a woman named Erin Radke. And then also, this was my dark horse, a cheese called Cave Age Chandoka from LeClaire Farms. It's a great cheese. It's a blend of cow and goat milk, and it's made in the style of a bandage cheddar. Didn't win, but it'll have its day.
And some Wisconsin cheeses won in their particular category.
They did. We performed really well in the different categories, actually. We won 46 out of the 121 classes of cheese.
Wow.
Some of the highlights there was in the traditional aged wax cheddar category. Wayne Hintz, he's a cheesemaker with Red Barn Family Farms near Appleton. He won first, second, and third in this category. And that's great, because Red Barn is a cool company. All their family farms have 50 or fewer cows, and they have something called the Red Barn Rules, which is an agreement to treat their animals really well and keep their cows happy. Also, in the natural rinded cheddar category, a new company, Door Artisan Cheese, out of Egg Harbor, took the top prize. And this is a really competitive category, so for a new company to take that really impressed me. Also, in string cheese, Caesar's Cheese, made in Gibbsville, Wisconsin, took first and third there. Caesar and his family, I think, are just about the only people around that still hand stretch their string cheese. It really kills the shoulders for people who do it. But Caesar learned how to do this from his grandmother in Oaxaca, Mexico, on their little farm, and he is committed to keeping things old school. And one more to give a shout out to would be Marika Penterman from Thorpe, Wisconsin. She won the flavored Gouda category with an onion and garlic Gouda.
Ooh. That sounds really good.
Yeah, and anytime Marika enters this category in any contest, she wins. She's a tremendous cheesemaker.
And these are Wisconsinites up against the world. I mean, people are coming from all over the world for this thing.
Definitely. And these cheeses are all really incredible, but it just shows how competitive this is. There are, I think, cheesemakers from 50-some countries there.
And one of them won the grand prize.
And it wasn't Wisconsin, unfortunately. It was a cheese called Escarou from southern France. It's an Haute-Savoie cheese made with sheep's milk. Sort of has a buttery, nutty, sometimes gamey flavor to it. And in second place, I can see Michelle is excited about that one. In second place, we had a cheese from Austria, and in third, one from Switzerland.
Okay. Well, Dean, did you get to sample lots of the cheese?
I sampled a lot of great cheese last night. It was more, like I said, more than I could ever eat. But people were excited going into that announcement, and I had to say the energy kind of dropped out of the room afterward.
Wisconsin didn't win.
Yeah, but it was a great event nonetheless.
Dean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's our own Dean Canetter, producer here, telling us what happened in this week's World Championship Cheese Contest held in Madison. Now, cooking is one thing when you have the day off. All day to cook, you can be as fancy as you want to be. But what about those times when you've got a quick turnaround? You just got home from work and you need food on the table in the next, say, half hour, maybe even less. Today's Food Friday theme is cooking on a deadline. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you cook when time is at a premium? What is your quick prep entree and or side dish? Do you plan in advance to have those meals ready to rock? If so, how? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson is here to help out. Hey, Judith.
Hey.
So what were you thinking about for your quick go-to meal?
So I didn't have to think too hard because I was actually enjoying leftovers of one today for lunch. So, we actually don't have a kid at home anymore, so we don't have a lot of the, you know, evening things. But often we've got a lot of things leading up to dinner and have to do something fast. So this is one of my absolute favorite ones, and it's only got a few ingredients, so that's really helpful. It's a Italian sausage, kale, and white bean kind of skillet. Mm-hmm. And so what you do is you get maybe one sausage per person. You break it out of the casing. So just brown that up really quickly and kind of crumbles. And then I usually use, say if you're doing three sausages, I do two cans of white kidney beans. Sometimes they're called cannellini beans. Open them both, drain one, but keep the juice from the other one. That kind of turns into the sauce. So once you've got the sausage browned up a little bit, I throw a few extra fennel seeds in. Can't go wrong with fennel seeds. If you've got time to throw in some raw garlic, you could. I actually use powdered roasted garlic. And then I put the beans in, one can that's drained, one can that's not. So that makes a little sauce. Let that heat up a little bit. In the meantime, rinse off some kale leaves. You can use spinach. To me, cooked spinach is a little on the slimy side. Kale leaves, rinse them off. Don't need to dry them. Just rip them up. Take out the rib of them. Throw them in the pan. Cover it. Let them wilt a little. And it's done.
On my clock, that sounds like, what, 12, 15 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. And then to finish it, and this makes it actually almost kind of fancy and really tasty, do a drizzle of balsamic vinegar.
Okay.
I know that sounds weird.
No, that's going to bring out a lot of the flavors, though.
Yeah, I was skeptical because it's a very savory dish, but the balsamic just really brings it together. So easy, so fast, really delicious, and really sticks with you.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234 as we cook on a deadline. Dee is with us in Kenosha. Dee, hi.
Oh, hi. I am into pre-planning, and I got into that because I was a nurse and worked different shifts. My husband got on a stupid swing shift thing.
Oh, no.
And we had four children over 10 years. So there's a different age there. We hit a point where everybody was coming and going at a different time. If you can give yourself a half an hour in the morning, you can throw stuff in a crock pot.
I'm a big fan of the crock pot, too, Dee. What are some of your go-tos in the crock pot?
Our favorite recipe, I call Soup of the Americas, and there was like some kind of recipe that had a couple things out of one of the women's magazines, and I thought, well, I could do better. Equal parts of a can of pumpkin, a can of diced tomatoes, juice and all, and then a can of broth. That's your base. I did season that with adobo. I love that seasoning. Penzies makes the best. And it's got cumin, it's got pepper, has no salt. It's a really healthy recipe, but it's got a whole variety of seasonings in it. And then you add to that whatever you've got. You usually drain and rinse a can of black beans, must go in there. I've grown bought and chopped up peppers, different colors, just green, whatever you got. Peppers in there, and just let it go.
That sounds fantastic, Dee. Soup of the Americas. I was trying to figure out how you get red, white, and blue ingredients to stay separate.
Yeah.
No, like pumpkin, native indigenous plants.
Sounds really hearty, too. And I think that's one of the things is fast doesn't mean you don't want it to stick with you.
Right.
So it's kind of combining those things, the speed and the substance to it.
Thanks for that, Dee. My crock pot go-to is just having a couple chicken breasts or maybe thighs. Throw them in the crock pot in the morning. If you want to be real fast, pour on some salsa. Boom.
Yeah.
Let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get fancier. You can add more stuff. You can, America's Test Kitchen says if you're doing onions or tomatoey stuff or vinegar, heat it in the microwave for a while before you dump it in. It's supposed to help bring out some of the flavors.
That makes sense.
So you can get a little fancier in the morning if you want, but you could have it in there in 2 minutes and walk out the door and be ready to go in the evening.
We're talking about cooking on a deadline, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we asked some of our coworkers what they were thinking, and a crockpot idea from Johanna from the WPR Pledge team. Her go-to is barbecue pulled pork tacos. She had me right there.
Yeah.
I didn't need to hear anymore, but she says she seasons the pork. She loves smoked paprika, which I do too. She cooks it on low in the crockpot for the day while she's at work. Then by the time she gets home, she just has to shred it, add some barbecue sauce, throw it in a tortilla with avocado, spinach, cheese, and onion, and voila, dinner. And she adds that we ask people what they keep around just for those kind of last minute things. She says onions, cheese, and spinach are always around because they're so versatile.
That's fantastic. The thing I always keep around, because I want to, especially as a parent, I want to have veggie as part of meals, always having a bunch of carrots, and they scale to any amount of time.
Yeah.
Real hurry, peel them or wash them, whatever, carrot sticks, great. A little more time, I grate them, mix them with salt, pepper, red wine vinegar, and olive oil, and make a slaw.
Oh, yeah. That's a very French carrot salad.
I still like it.
You're just bitter about
little
the
more
cheese.
Time. Yeah, they stole it. They stole that award. Cut up into sticks and throw them on the stovetop if you got a little more time. A little more time still. Pop in the oven, oven roasted carrots, just however much time you have, carrots are going to work at any level. We are looking for your meals on a deadline, cooking with not much time. Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you plan in advance or do you have quick food that you make on the spot? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. More of your suggestions coming up on Central Time. It's Food Friday. We're cooking on a deadline. We want your advice and suggestions for people who need to cook meals fast. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we have Robert in Madison up first, so let's go there. Hi, Robert. What do you have for us?
Well, I kind of call it bachelor chow, for lack of a better term. Start some rice cooking in the microwave, and while that's going on, cut up and just fry in a little olive oil, a chicken breast, dump in a bag of oriental vegetables, a little bit of soy sauce, just fry it up as a quick stir fry, put it over rice, boom, you're done.
That's and it sounds pretty tasty too, Robert.
Yeah, no, it's not bad at all, actually. And, obviously you could use fancier stir fry sauces or get a little more creative if you wanted to. But between that and crock pot, you can basically kind of take care of everything.
Robert, thank you so much for sharing your bachelor chow with us. We'll go next to Meg in Montello. Meg, hi.
Hi. So my husband is a deer hunter, and we always end up with a freezer full of deer between he and my son. And looking for new and different ways to deal with all of this venison, I found that if I take a frozen venison roast, throw it in the crock pot, pour a little bit of liquid from banana peppers over the top of it and a couple of banana peppers in there with it. Let it cook all day on medium. On the way home, stop and pick up some ready-made pico de gallo and some guacamole and things like that if I'm really in a hurry and don't have time to make those things, and some flour tortillas, and boom, we have pulled it apart with forks, and we're ready to go. We have a meal.
Great. And the venison, it's just seasoned with the banana peppers and their juice, nothing else in there?
Nothing else, and it is amazing. It's so tender, and it tastes, kind of cuts out that gaminess a little bit, and we've actually tried it with beef roast, and it's not nearly as good.
Meg, thank you so much for sharing that. That sounds fantastic. Judith, you want to share a couple other tips from our colleagues?
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. Kelly, who's a producer with Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television, has a delicious idea that I have to say I never even thought about, but then when I started thinking Korean stuff, it made a lot of sense. It's rice, egg, and kimchi. Just three ingredients.
You've got that jar of kimchi, I guess.
Yeah. So you've got a jar of kimchi, and if you've got pre-cooked rice, that's great. Otherwise, she says a pressure cooker with a rice setting is also nice. 12-minute rice is perfect, so that definitely keeps it under our self-imposed deadline. And she loves it for a fast dinner because it's tasty, warm, and a good vegetarian option with a good bit of protein. And she makes the egg fried over easy, but I think you could do it any way you like. That sounds really comforting to me.
No, I want it over easy because I like it when then it explodes all over the rest of the food.
Yeah, like, but like in bibimbap or anything like that, yeah, it sounds great. Yeah, I thought that was a really good one. And another veggie option, WPR News fellow Mary Lee Williams has one that sounds hearty enough to please anyone. Her chickpea salad sandwich has garbanzo beans, also called chickpeas, olive oil, celery, and green olives. I like that touch
a lot. And you just smoosh them all together?
She just mixes it up, and then she said you can put it on in a pita or something, but she says you can also eat it out of a bowl with greens, and those garbanzo beans have a lot of protein. So again, they're going to stick with you.
Sounds pretty good.
I like that. I actually make a chickpea salad that's got kind of a vinaigrette with cumin, ground cumin as the seasoning.
Well, that sounds really good too. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeremiah is with us in Kenosha. Jeremiah, hi.
Hi. I have an integrated family. Generally, I feed around 10 people at night at dinner time. And so although the crock pot is a great thing, planning 2-3 meals in advance is always one of the things that saves me. If I throw a pork shoulder in the crock pot today, I can use that to do pulled pork for tomorrow and use the bone mix stew, with some beans and some, stock from, the previous meals. It can carry one meal into the next. It can generally get through 2-3 nights, using that first meal as a base.
I love that, Jeremiah. How big a crock pot do you have if you're feeding 10 people?
Generally, we've got 2 crock pots, and if we've got 2 meals planned, we've got one set up for the next one, set up for the next one that way.
Tag team crock pots. Wow. I love it, Jeremiah. Thanks for that. That's something I do too, where you have the double use ingredients. So if you got that pulled chicken from the crock pot, it's tacos tonight and then maybe chilaquiles in a couple days, or I'll throw it, if I have just a little bit left, I'll throw it in the next soup I make. I love like the double use of that. Jeremiah, thanks a lot.
And especially when it's grilling weather, I hate firing up the grill and only doing like 2 little things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I grill a bunch of stuff, chicken, maybe burgers, veggies, all that kind of stuff, and then, I use it in following days.
Yeah, pre-cooked chicken breast is great to throw out a salad the next day. Yeah, that's a lot of great uses for that. I will go next to Jeremy calling from Ashland. Jeremy, hi.
Yeah, hi. I've got 2 go-tos that are any pretty much last minute, give you 20 minutes, 30 minutes. One of them's a good old favorite, a tater tot hot dish, either ground venison, ground beef, a pound of that, a couple cans of creamy mushroom soup, maybe corn or beans, top it off with tater tots, and you're done in 20 minutes. Another one of my go-tos is an egg scramble. Scrambled eggs, diced up potatoes, mushrooms, pork sausage, bacon. I've been making it a lot lately with crab meat.
Crab meat.
Top her off with cheese after she's done, and I've actually got leftovers for work the next day.
And that's a great one because you're using one pan, right? And only one pan to clean up.
Usually one pan, yeah.
Jeremy, thank you so much for those suggestions at 800-642-1234. We're cooking on a deadline, cooking food when we don't have a whole bunch of time to do something fancy. Another tip from my household is, I know not everybody's into tofu. We're not a veggie household, but tofu is great because you cube it up, you fry it. It takes really just minutes, and then you can mix it with stir-fried vegetables, and we just keep jars of, we'll always have teriyaki sauce or different kinds of pad Thai sauce right. or whatever. And so it's not exactly the same thing each time. It's easy to mix that up. That's super fast. And I make rice just on the stovetop. Mm-hmm. That takes 12 minutes.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of old school. We don't have a crock pot and we don't have an Instapot or anything.
I think crock pots are old school.
Okay. I'm prehistoric, but I don't know. But you know what? It's surprising how quickly chicken will cook if you're basically like poaching it or simmering it. And so one of the things that I do is take, you know, kind of a shallow pan with a lid, put a can of diced tomatoes in there. If you have time to saute up some onions and garlic, you can do those first, put in the tomatoes, and then just nestle cut up chicken breasts or those chicken thighs, the boneless, skinless on both, kind of nestle them in there, cover it while you're maybe making some rice or some pasta or something on the side or a salad. It poaches it really fast. And then I throw some black olives in at the end, and it's kind of a Mediterranean thing.
And the curse of poaching is, or the thing to be careful about, it's really easy to overcook it, right? You want to make sure you don't go too nuts and make it tough.
Right. But, you know, we're on a deadline, Rob.
We don't have time to overcook our chicken. Back to your calls now. Stacy is with us in Menasha. Stacy, hi.
Hey there. How are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Stacy?
Well, I always have a few packs of Uncle Ben's brown rice, just the kind you throw in the microwave. It takes 90 seconds. And I'll do that and throw that in a bowl with a can of black beans, a can of corn, a can of diced tomatoes with like Mexican flavors. And then that would be a veggie option. And then if I have, like you were talking about earlier, grilled chicken breast or some ground turkey or anything like that, I throw it on top and warm it up, and it's a whole meal.
Stacy, thank you so much for sharing that. That kind of takes me back. That was kind of my bachelor chow for a long time, a very similar sort of rice and beans concoction. Mm-hmm. Cook up the rice, can of beans, can of tomato, something, and whatever else you got, onions.
That's fast and cheap.
Yeah, and you can make a lot of it. I mean, I'm kind of a creature of habit. I used to be able to eat that every day, sometimes twice a day for a week. I mean, you're living. That's cheap. That's cheap and fast. I love it.
And healthy.
Have we missed? Maureen McCollum had one. Did we read that one?
No, we didn't. Maureen loves fajitas.
Yeah, she had a Tex-Mex fajita thing. She says chicken, steak, beans, or veggies can work well. She throws in onions, peppers, garlic, and whatever other veggies she has lying around. Spices, cumin, garlic powder, salt, pepper. Saute it all up. Add cheese, sour cream, or Greek yogurt. Wrap it in a tortilla and, in her words, boom. So 15, 20 minutes, she says, fajitas and tacos make Maureen very happy.
They make me happy, too, especially if someone makes them for me.
That sounds great. Thank you all so much for everyone who called in and all of our colleagues. We had some pasta recommendations. Yeah, actually, that if you get the not dry pasta, if you have fresh pasta available, that tends to cook up even
really
faster than the dry
Almost
stuff.
Too fast. That you can overcook.
That is easy to overcook. Yeah, but that's, I mean, 2-3 minutes a lot of the time. Hey, you can keep sharing your cooking on a deadline suggestions. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or there's a conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can just scroll down there, see what other people are suggesting, and throw your ideas in there as well, and maybe we'll cook some for ourselves over the course of this weekend. Again, that's the Ideas Network Facebook page. We spring forward into daylight savings time this weekend, but Florida lawmakers just passed a bill that could keep them in daylight savings time forever if it's signed into law by the governor, and for some reason it has to be approved by Congress. But we still lose an hour this weekend. Producer Chris Molina is here with me. Chris, do you miss that hour every year?
I mean, when Sunday rolls around, I'm going to grumble like heck about it because I'm going to be a little sleep deprived. Like, I'm a kind of a creature of habit. I usually get up at the same time. So I'm going to be really disoriented on Sunday. But I think once like the week settles in, you know, Monday and Tuesday rolls around and you have that extra hour of daylight, I'm going to feel way more motivated. Like, I don't know about you, Rob, but I get home and it's 5 o'clock and it's dark and I'm like, it feels like it's 10 o'clock at night. I kind of want to go to bed. So having that extra sunlight at the end of the day, I think, goes a long way.
It's kind of nice. And in my head, it's like, oh, great, in the fall still, I'll get that hour back.
Yeah.
I always waste it. I just stay up too late, I don't know, playing a computer game or something. I don't really make the most of that extra hour.
I know. I always, like, try to justify, oh, yeah, I can stay up an extra hour, you know, like goofing around, watching Netflix or something, because, you know, we're just going to lose it and gain it back. But I am going to love having the extra daylights this coming week and then going forward.
And the big thing for radio producers, producers this time of year always remind all the guests to change their clocks.
It should be a given, but I know it's bit you and I a couple times in the past.
We've both been hit by that, definitely. Remember, spring forward, Sunday, 2 a.m. or so. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.